information, knowledge and society. So Steve, would you like to start? Thank you.
Okay, I'm recording this. I hope that's okay with people.
Sure. Everyone happy about that?
Basically because given the informal setting that Alistair's arranged, I'm going to talk about something that, in a sense, I haven't written about before, but we'll have an article completed by the 31st of May for the Journal of Information Ethics, and I've got this now on tape. Because I'm keeping track of the information. Okay, and so what I'm going to talk about is what I said in the title was infobesity, but sometimes I've talked about it as epistemobesity. And it's the too much information problem, okay? I'm coming at this primarily from the academic side, and because I think that's the context where in a sense this starts to raise certain issues about, you know, the sort of the normative arrangements that we have as academics, where we're always being asked to produce more and more and more, and of course we're asked to be producing stuff of more quality, but that usually corresponds to just producing more in the first place, okay? And yet at the same time, we know that most of the stuff that's actually published is not read, and if it is read, it is not cited. And so there's a sense in which, and indeed, academic journals are very much set up this way, that most of the stuff that we in fact write is for, quote, archival purposes. That is to say, you know, for PhD students who don't yet know well enough that most of this stuff could be ignored, right? I mean, you know, so the thing is that it is meant for something in the future, even though it is written to, you know, written ostensibly to be about cutting edge, you know, what's happening now, what I have just done yesterday. Nevertheless, if it is ever appreciated at all, if it's not appreciated within a relatively short period of time, it will probably not be realized until after you're already gone. Okay, so it's a very funny kind of audience situation, you might say, if you look at this from a rhetorical standpoint. You know, for whom exactly are you writing? Okay, so that's kind of the situation, you might say, from where the academics are coming from and facing this kind of issue, which I think we all recognize, okay? But then there's this other issue, which in a way is superimposed on it, and it's kind of the issue that motivates people talking about obesity and all these very negative terms about there being too much. Because after all, we are, as academics, encouraged to contribute to this obesity, right? So the question is, for whom is this obese? For whom is this a pathological condition? And so this is where one starts to think about where does the idea of information overload come from? What's the context in which that's being framed? And of course, that's being framed in the context of decision making, right? And in a way, a very kind of classical, and when I say classical, I mean like Shannon Weaver style information theory, where in a sense, the point of having information is to give you something that can enable you to make a decision, right? So the standpoint is the standpoint of the decision maker. And in a sense, you obviously need some information, because if you don't have enough information, you can't make a decision. But of course, if you have too much information, that will inhibit you from making a decision as well. Right? So the point is there's a kind of optimizing problem going on here about what is sufficient information to have to be able to make a decision. And it's in that way of looking at things that the concept of information overload comes into play. Now, it's an interesting concept in itself, and it's very much connected to what in the more general literature of rationality is called bounded rationality. Herbert Simon, you may know, one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence, talks about this idea. You may have run across satisficing. Satisficing. I think most of you have heard of this idea, right? It's in a way meant to be, because the idea of optimizing suggests that there's some kind of ideal position of information adequacy that could be a basis for decision making. But what Simon is saying is, given that you're not just making one decision, but you're going to be making several decisions, the point is to get enough information so you can make a decision that gets you to the next decision. Right? So you want it sufficient. It doesn't have to be ideal, it doesn't even have to be optimal, right, in terms of your own goals. But it has to be good enough to get you to the next decision. And you see, the more you operate within that kind of concept, then the kinds of knowledge that we're producing these days seems to be surplus to requirements. Okay? So this is where kind of the issue comes from. Clearly this is not an idea that respects the notion of knowledge for its own sake or anything of that kind, and we might want to return to that at some point. Exactly where is the value of knowledge for its own sake in this argument, if at all? But let me move to talk about a little bit about the obesity metaphor, okay? Because the obesity metaphor, if you look at obesity, right, more energy than you know what to do with, okay? And this is, in a sense, more knowledge than you know what to do with. I think this is kind of the way you should be running this. And so you've got two options. You can either stop eating, that is to say, stop storing new energy, right? Or you can get more exercise and you can use that energy that's been stored. There are two ways, if you look at the way universities are organized, you might say there are two different kind of angles one might play on this. In terms of not producing more knowledge, but in some sense scaling down one's consumption of knowledge, I would say that in a sense, this is kind of a very kind of classical model of the way we think about teaching, okay? Especially if you're a person who actually has knowledge and you're imparting it, one of the things that you're doing is that you're not, as it were, making it more difficult, but you're making it less difficult. So you're making it easier, as it were. The next generation, as it were, can use less to get as far as others have gone. So it's a more energy efficient way from an epistemic standpoint to get to the same point that you yourself and others in the past have gotten to. Okay? And it seems to me that this kind of strategy, of course, works, because otherwise we would be in a position of having to say that each generation has to learn everything that every previous generation had learned, right, in order to be adequate. And of course, that's not the case, right? There's a kind of reduction that takes place at the level of the classroom, which is a salutary reduction, which actually makes the student fighting fit, as it were, to go forward with the knowledge that has been accumulated from the previous generations. Okay? So there's a kind of a reduction, a consumption reduction going on there. Now, what would it mean, now, the idea of producing more knowledge to, as it were, displace or, go beyond the knowledge that's already there? This is where I think the research function comes in a very specific kind of way. And this is where I think you need to take the scientific ethos at its word. Not necessarily as it's actually played out, but kind of at its word. And the idea is to displace previous forms of knowledge. Right? So in other words, I produce something, I'm exercising the knowledge that I have gained from the past that's been stored in me for purposes of getting rid of a lot of that previous knowledge by superseding it. So I am using that stored energy to produce new knowledge. Okay? And then it becomes the task of the next generation to do similarly. Otherwise, it will become info-obese. Right? So in a sense, part of what you're doing when you're producing new knowledge is getting rid of the old stuff. And that's what justifies, as it were, the epistemic calorie intake. Okay? So there is this kind of destruction going on. That is, and science is very explicit on this point in the way in which other parts of knowledge are not. But science certainly, I think, is explicit on this. And so you've got these two things happening at the university, and you might say these are ways of managing the kind of information overload problem that's being talked about. There's an interesting book that came out a few years ago by Anne Blair. I don't know if anyone's familiar with her. She's a historian. It's called Too Much to Know, and it's basically about the early modern period and where you start to get a kind of this trend. You know, the early modern period is interesting for lots of reasons. Of course, it's when the scientific revolution happens, but it's also a transition point between what we would now identify as kind of ancient and medieval attitudes and what we would see as the modern attitudes toward the management of knowledge. And so it's an interesting kind of site for looking at this. And the point that she makes, which I think everyone who knows some history knows, is that everybody's always been talking about there's too much information and too much knowledge, right? They've always been talking about this. And the interesting thing, there are a couple of things to look at, right? Namely, where do people think the problem comes from, and what do people think they ought to be doing about it, right? So there are these two issues. Now, in the past, it was pretty clear that the idea of too much information, so let's say, when I say the past, I mean before we start to get mass-produced books, that the problem of too much information came from the fact that every time somebody, that there were so few books around, there were so few general records around, that everyone, as it were, had to be starting from scratch to produce stuff, to be able to incorporate everything that they needed to, that the reader would need to know, because the reader could not be expected to have their own library, even if the reader was literate, right? So the point is that the literacy issue isn't the issue, it's the availability of the written materials for a person who wants to study and go forward with the thing being talked about. So it becomes important, it becomes necessary, in a sense, to, in some sense, reproduce the library in your text, right? And then what you do is you give your spin. And there are people like Elizabeth Eisenstein, for example, a very important historian of the emergence of publishing, right, who says this is one of the reasons why it was so slow to make any kind of progress, is because if everybody, in a sense, had at the outset to reproduce the entire library before they could say anything, right, then this took a long time in itself, okay? And then there wasn't really a lot of space for you to develop your own viewpoint. So, but what this meant was, if you think about the medieval period, if you know about that, right, you have all these different commentaries on the Bible, all these different commentaries on Aristotle, right? And then, the problem is if you've got access to all these things, then you have to somehow reconcile them and make sense of them. And this takes a lot of time, and more of these things are accumulating. And again, this is before mass publishing takes place. So in other words, we're getting accumulations of texts that are reproducing everything, but there is no, as it were, easy to access library or anything of that kind. And so what this led to was kind of the first expression of information overload, which you see in Thomas Aquinas, okay, who was a contributor to this problem. It was known as acidia, right? So the acidification of the soul. Right, because there's a sense in which you say, oh my God, there's all this stuff to read, and anything that I might think, somebody's already said before. Because I'm reading the same text they're reading, so what's the point? And he thought that monks, who spent a lot of time, studying and compiling and actually engaged in knowledge work, were subject to this kind of problem. And Aquinas thought this was, in fact, the specific sin of scholarship. The sin that was associated, the weakness of the soul, the weakness of the will associated with scholarship was this acidia, where you become kind of a cynic, say, I've seen it before, etc. And you don't feel the need to go forward, okay? Now, the advent of the printing press and mass publishing and all of this, in a way, gets rid of that problem, in a sense, because, in a sense, you don't have to be reproducing what everybody, you don't have to rethink everybody's thoughts. You can just refer to them, right? And there are these books, and the books are sufficiently available that other people can verify for themselves, so it's not an impossible task. But then you get to this other kind of problem that starts to arise in the end of the 18th century, which is an interesting problem, in a way is being addressed now somewhat by the scientific community. And this is the problem of the need for authorship. The need for authorship, right? Because if you think about it, when you're making a contribution to knowledge, in a sense, you have to personally authorize it. And this is one of the reasons why a lot of the kind of conventions that are associated with the academic presentation of knowledge are the way they are, like the literature review. You have to somehow give a kind of path by which one gets to what one wants to do, even if what one wants to do is just a kind of an epicycle or something considerably minor. There's got to be this backstory, right, that's being given, and it's a theoretical backstory and a methodological backstory, and then, the last two pages, that's what you do, right? That's your thing, right? But nevertheless, you have to actually have to write the whole thing out, and it's not that trivial, right? And people do take it seriously, and they do think of it as kind of the way they get into it. It's their personality invested. And insofar as authorship matters, and it does matter, right? Obviously, because we use this way of presenting knowledge as a basis of crediting people in academia, right? So the authorship thing does matter in a way. That creates an overload problem, Because then what you're dealing with is multiple idiosyncratic ways of presenting perhaps what is essentially the same method or the same theory or whatever. And rather than just letting people being able to get away with just citing the thing in where it originally appears, instead you have to somehow narrativize it. Okay, so that then creates another layer. And so the overload problem comes in there, right? So there are people in the scientific community, you know, who, I think the kind of issue I'm talking about here is especially one that social scientists and humanists are very sensitive to. But I think in the natural science community, where the issue of authorship really often doesn't extend beyond kind of like the sort of originality for a patent kind of thing, you know, namely, I'm the one who did this experiment, right? It doesn't matter whether you buy all the bullshit I said, you know, for the last 15 pages, as long as you give me credit for the thing I did in the lab. Right, that there is a move in a way to minimize, to sort of manage this kind of information overload problem, to just, you know, because scientific referencing is very efficient and it's very detailed, and you know, scientists will write 2-page articles with 150 references, and that in a sense can actually map out where the guy is coming from without him having to use any words, right? And all the words have to do is to provide some kind of stylization of the distinctive contribution that this guy's making. So you could have, in principle, a couple of paragraphs plus 150 citations afterwards, and that would be your contribution of knowledge, and that would really reduce the information overload. And then you could start using the kinds of analytics you're talking about to map out the relationship between the references and so forth. And you'd also be able to spot more easily areas where different forms of knowledge are not interacting with each other very much because people who are writing in one area aren't citing people writing in another area. And you wouldn't be distracted by the words. Now, of course, bibliometrics and scientometrics in a way kind of already assumes this, right? Because if you're familiar with those fields within information science, right, they don't pay, you know, they don't really pay attention to the text. They're actually more concerned with the references. And I think a lot of scientists are coming to the conclusion that, in fact, that is kind of where the action is. And so that would be one way of eliminating the information overload. And there is this whole concept that has been organized around this idea, which some of you may have run across, I don't know, called undiscovered public knowledge. Undiscovered public knowledge, the phrase was coined about 30 years ago by Donald Swanson, who was a library scientist at the University of Chicago, a man originally trained in physics, and he was able to come up with a hypothesis that turned out to work cure a disorder called Raynaud's syndrome, which has to do with the fingertips becoming cold, becoming numb. And he made the hypothesis that fish oil might be able to deal with this matter, but that was because he was reading across literatures, okay? And so what he did was he did some searches about, you know, putting in some key words from the original disease, but putting it in different literatures, and then coming up with things that ended up working, but of course these literatures don't normally, talk to each other. So, and again, what we have here is knowledge that already exists. It's already out there, but it's not being exploited properly. And he was proposing this as a kind of, you know, that one could think about this as a systematic way of exploiting knowledge that's already there, so as it were, the overload doesn't just get seen to be as superfluous or useless, but actually gets in some way used. It gets energized for some kind of purpose. And it might also save some money in terms of commissioning grants for new research where what people are doing is just reinventing the wheel. Right? I mean, that's another issue that's kind of a part of this as well. Let me just check. Okay, my time's almost up. The one thing, though, that I would say that is because I actually think this is kind of the general position I'm scoping out is a kind of an interesting way to think about this issue of information obesity. But I do want to come back to the issue of the authorship issue because one of the things that made science appear in the 18th century and 19th century as such a distinctive human contribution, in other words, part of our humanity, not just contributing to material progress, but part of the constitution of humanity, was its being seen as a form of free expression. So the knowledge for its own sake idea, right? And so the free, and how do you, you know, how does that appear textually? Right? That is going to appear by the distinctive, the idiosyncratic way in which you are putting together pieces of knowledge in order to draw some kind of novel conclusion, right? And so if you look at the German Romantics and so forth, who had this kind of, and they're the ones who actually came up with this very robust notion of authorship, I might add, Fichte in particular, was the one who came up with the kind of philosophical justification for copyright and stuff like this. And so this kind of notion of the author as mattering, in other words, it becomes important to know who wrote the thing. It's not just important that the thing is true, but it's important to know who wrote it. Comes from the late 18th century, from Fichte. Somebody like Goethe was always seen as kind of this kind of exemplar, right, of a man who authored his own science, right? A guy who was competent in many areas, put the thing together, and had his distinctive stamp on it, okay? And that kind of vision, though we often, when we tell the history of science, we make Goethe look very much like an outlier to the way in which the history of science developed. I think that's a bit of Whiggish history, because if you actually look at the 19th century, this kind of idea of coming up with an original insight into the world, and that, as it were, being a mark of your humanity and your self-expression, that was actually a very strong impulse. And you see this, we could talk about this in more historical detail, but the point is, this is something that's definitely there. And it's only with the kind of massification of knowledge in the 20th century that then, you know, and when you start to have, as it were, reference lists that start to get longer than the articles themselves, that then this kind of issue we're talking about, that, you know, there's too much information around, becomes a problem. So what I want to suggest, in other words, is that I wonder whether the concern about too much information is ultimately a kind of concern about too many authors, okay? That in a sense, this is not just about managing material, and because in a sense that could be managed pretty easily in the way that I have suggested, but rather what we're talking about is managing free expression in a sense, and whether free expression should be made visible in the kind of way that traditional notions of authorship in science have allowed, okay. And I think that's one of the things. If you follow seriously the proposals that scientists are making now to minimize the amount of text and to keep the reference list long and as comprehensive as possible, then what you're killing is authorship from science, and potentially the sense in which science can be a form of human self-expression. And I'll stop there.
Very interesting. Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
Just an observation, when you were developing the obesity analogy, it struck me that I take your point that science seems to consume itself and replace itself, and that does work in effect, so it fits the analogy nicely.
Yeah.
Arts and humanities don't.
Right, exactly.
The point of, and yet they still exist.
Yes.
It struck me that the current REF process of the impact agenda is one in which effectively you're taking a surplus and trying to make better use of it.
Exactly.
And you do that through doing work by producing impacts. You're almost literally pushing an audience along in your direction.
That's right.
It fits the analogy.
That's right.
The other one is, towards the end, you were mentioning about masses of data and using previous data in new ways, and that's the whole data mining analogy.
Exactly. No, I was thinking, I had that in the back of my mind.
As a physical analogy, digging up, or burrowing deeper into things.
Well, but I mean, in this respect, there is this contrasting notion, which I would put on the table in case people aren't familiar with, data surfacing, okay? And data surfacing, because the thing about data mining is data mining works because you already kind of know what you're looking for, and you can then burrow in and find it. But data surfacing is actually to take the full range of data and presume it's all valuable, potentially. By the way, intelligence services love this idea of data surfacing, right? Because when you're looking for terrorists, you never know how they're going to pop up. And they're not necessarily going to pop up according to the categories you've already programmed. So what you want to do is have a kind of... Right. Yeah. And so what you want is a very open-minded attitude. And this is what data surfacing is about. Namely, to see patterns that are already there, regardless of whether you were looking for them. And it's an interesting thing, because to be able to, and this is what undiscovered public knowledge is about in a sense, right? Because the idea of undiscovered public knowledge presumes that even though a lot of knowledge is being produced, nevertheless, relatively little of it is actually exploited, because people are operating within fairly narrow blinders, and so a lot of it just gets ignored. But the point is, if you had a more kind of holistic view of the whole data thing, the whole data scene that's out there, then you'd be able to exploit the thing more effectively. And the intelligence services are on top of this idea, and it's too bad the academics aren't. But the intelligence services are. In fact, this firm in Silicon Valley, Palantir, P-A-L-A-N-T-I-R, if you don't know about them, they are the great masters of data surfacing. And what they do is they bring in their people to help the National Security Agency or whomever, right, how to scope out their data, which, you know, it's out there in some visual form, but they're only looking at it from a very narrow standpoint, how to actually be open to all the patterns that are potentially out there, which then they can start to explore.
Could I
just raise a question about?
I'll
step back.
No,
sorry.
You do first, then call.
Okay, about data versus interpretation, mm-hmm. and I suspect that the problem with analysing vast amounts of data very often is that people don't actually have the understanding to be making sense of it, and you're kind of assuming that that software can achieve.
No, the point I made about Palantir is they bring one of their people out there. This is my point, right? Palantir just doesn't sell you software. It actually gets you to hire, for a temporary period of time, one of their people who can train you to see the patterns more effectively. That's their shtick. If you go to their website, that's what they do that's different from the other firms.
Okay, but the more general point that I wanted to make, going on from that, was that I wondered whether what you were saying had greater relevance to the physical sciences than to humanities or social sciences. And by that I mean that very often, in the latter, what one's trying to do is about analysis or interpretation or emphasis. It's about telling a different narrative in relation to the same set of, the facts or the physical reality, if you like. And I wondered whether you see any difference between...
Yeah, but I think the question... Look, I think the question to ask about that, you're right, there is a prima facie difference, but the question is, what is motivating the humanist or social scientist to actually want to provide an alternative narrative, right? And this is where the question of authorship comes in. I think one needs to take more seriously, perhaps even than social scientists or humanists are inclined to take, the role of self-expression. In other words, I'm looking at this data, I have a different take on this, that matters. Right? In other words, you don't assume there's just kind of one take on the data and the first guy to get it wins. But rather that there are multiple takes and each person's take on it in a way kind of matters. And that's much more like a self-expression model.
You're into politics of expression.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing is that I think that the whole business of quote managing information overload basically reduces the capacity for self-expression. Science is a form of self-expression, and see, here's what I would say. I would say that social scientists and humanists are a little bit too much on the fence on this matter, because in a sense they don't want to really be upfront and saying, but it is self-expression. When I have a different take on a set of data, it's because I actually see it differently, and the fact that I'm seeing it differently matters. Because that's really what the argument is. Otherwise, you're going to be pushed into this position of who's seeing this data better, you know? And the first guy to get there wins, and the rest of you are just, you know, in the dustbin of history.
Okay, I don't really understand that, but all I wanted to say really was that I think you're slandering the humanists and the social sciences, because they can say this, you know, I mean, and it's the picture you're painting, I think, you know, is you're attacking a straw person here, because there is a very well commented on, and you know, whether you're talking to people face to face or whether you're reading their works, there's a clear sense that what people are doing, what I'm doing as an intellectual historian or as a political theorist, is presenting an interpretation of a set of texts.
But it's not enough.
And they do it, and what's changed is that the government has changed its position so that now the impact stuff becomes the driver of research, and that's what's being pushed out.
Well, no,
so you can't, you know, you're an agency to the wrong people.
No, look, I think the big mistake you're making in how you're presenting your case is by calling it an interpretation. If you stood up for, say, it's my interpretation, and my interpretation matters because self-expression matters in academia, that's how you would start to counter the rhetoric of information overload.
Change those two letters.
No, but
you
that's
can change AM to
no, but it's interesting. Part of the academic ethos is always to have a kind of distant standpoint from the, even if it's one's own distinctive narrative. One wants to present it in a quote objective way. So we talk about an interpretation, multiple interpretations.
What happens is somebody will say, "I will present a liberal neutralist interpretation of issues around freedom of information." And this is my interpretation based on this literature and my previous work. So it is like this.
But this is where the politics lies. Yeah. It's in the self-expression. So I don't think because I'm putting this not in the context of the impact agenda, which is another matter, but in the context of information overload.
It's the same.
Well, it's not quite the same. The information overload, I think, is a bigger kind of issue about the whole point of producing knowledge in the first place and how it gets managed. And I'm saying that the way that knowledge gets managed is a lot implicitly has to do with how you're managing people and people's ability to express themselves. And I think this is an issue that goes beyond the ref, actually. Because even if we got rid of the ref, the information overload issue would still be there.
I like an idea of the ref is spin. In other words, there's a limited quantity and the ref just spins that quantity in terms of impact statements and all the rest. It's spinning a finite quantity of information. Great debate. I think maybe we better
sure.
Part that.
I'm fine.
And move on to the next speaker. Thanks for that, Steve.